If you ask me, who's an essential worker? Someone who has a job. Everyone who has a job in this economy is an essential worker. Every single job that is being done in our economy with these severe restrictions that is taking place is essential.
It's Monday, the 18th of May, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration. And today's podcast, I and Abby Steele are going to be talking to Sanushka Mudalia, who is an old colleague of mine from Australia. But before we do that, I wanted to give Abby the opportunity to talk a little bit about this new advice coming out from the RIVM, which is our version of the CDC in the Netherlands, about how young people should be coping with the restrictions and the lockdown.
Yeah, hi Darshan. So this week I saw actually in British newspapers, it was covered by the BBC and The Guardian. That's how I learned about our Dutch policy or our Dutch advice, which was, I mean, it made headlines because it was basically recommending for single people. I'm not sure about this ageism you're exhibiting here, Darshan. I don't think it was specifically for young people.
Oh, wasn't it?
I think it's anybody who's single. Acknowledging that people's sexual health is also part of their well-being. And so therefore, if you are single, maybe you should choose a sex buddy and, you know, pair up with that person during social distancing period or, you know, sex in the time of Corona, I guess. And so naturally, you know, the British found this pretty funny and on brand for the Dutch. And yeah. And I think it is. And this came after apparently a woman wrote a column in one of the big papers here saying that sex is a human right. And, you know, during social distancing, that is being violated. And I mean, I just find a lot of these things like very. So let's say I think that it is on brand also for the Dutch approach, which is basically like, how do we keep individuals happy and, you know, healthy? And there's been some talk about mental health, which I think is really good as well. But then, you know, they miss, you know, they're looking at every tree more than the forest. Like, at the same time, they're really worried about our sexual well-being. Like, we still don't wear masks, you know, like the idea of like, public health still not fully embraced here, in my opinion. So
I'm also wondering, like, I mean, is this the sort of thing that people need guidance about, right? Like, I mean, surely if that's what you want, you can choose, right? And
I know
no one's telling you you have to stay home all the time anyway.
Well, that's right? The other thing that I find very interesting and ironic, maybe a tension, if you will, between like wanting a lot of privacy. There's a lot of talk about privacy here and also wanting some distance from the state and its influence in your private life. And then at the same time, making some demand on the state to guarantee this human right is protected. I find that to be, you know, not 100% consistent as an outlook.
So I'm going to take this opportunity to introduce Sanushka Mudalia, who is a consultant and also a government advisor with 18 years of experience in senior policy advice, legal research and program management. And she's currently working on a lot of migrant rights issues in Australia, and it's with that in mind that we brought her on today.
First time I met Sanushka was when she was introducing me to the wonders of naltrexone. Which you may not even remember this. It's a drug utilized for people who are addicted to heroin to get them off that drug. And you were taking me to a seminar at Sydney University saying, this is the wonder drug, the drug of the future. And you obviously, by the look on your face on Zoom,
I remember it very clearly actually, but, I'm wondering whether you've forgotten that you were actually my tutor that semester for a course on
yes,
international institutions in Asia, I believe.
Maybe you could start off by giving us a sense about, I mean, all I've seen from Australia really during the crisis is this one image of, so our equivalent of the sexual advice story for the Netherlands was the kangaroo hopping through the streets of Adelaide, which is the typical, what everyone wants to see from Australia. But obviously there's a broader picture about how you're dealing with the crisis and what's going on.
That's there. Your hometown, right, Darshan? Adelaide.
Adelaide is my hometown.
Yeah, so you
yes,
had to
yes,
feel
yes,
especially
super
proud.
Super embarrassing. Yeah.
I actually didn't hear that story. I'm in Sydney. Yeah.
Because you see kangaroos every day, so it's not news
no,
to
No, because they just don't pay any attention to Adelaide.
Yeah, because I mean, I spent part of my childhood in Adelaide, so I, you know, don't knock Adelaide. Okay. And I should say actually that the sex buddy story made the news in Australia as well.
Of course,
it was. I read it in the newspaper yesterday, so it's not just the British that.
It's the entire Commonwealth.
Look at the Dutch
in fact.
Pragmatism. Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, I'm sure I read it because it was syndicated from a UK newspaper. So Australia has the geographical advantage of being able to really shut our borders. And I think that's part of the reason why I guess we are considered one of the success stories of the pandemic. Mm. As of today, I was looking at the figures a moment ago, there were about 7,000 cases in total, mm-hmm. about 100 deaths. And today in Australia, there were 9 new cases. And we've had a couple of days where some of the states in our federation reported 0 cases. So right. It's actually, and the restrictions have started to ease, bearing in mind that the original restrictions were less restrictive than other parts of the world, in the sense that pubs and cafes and movie theatres and sporting venues and all those other things were closed, but shops remained open, and it was basically left up to the owners of big brands and smaller shops to decide whether or not they could stay open, and then to determine whether they could implement the distancing requirements that were necessary to stay open. So there wasn't a government-mandated shutdown. Things like dentists and optometrists, which have been closed in the UK for quite some time now, remained open for the duration. Schools were shut to all but non-essential workers, but the definition of... Sorry, shut to all but essential for the kids and essential workers, but the definition of what that was left fairly open. So in theory... you could have been sending your kids to school the whole time, although in practice a very, very tiny number of people actually did that. Although now schools have reopened one day a week in some states and not in others. So overall, we were allowed to leave the house for exercise and for essential shopping only until about a week ago. But again, the definitions of those things, you could meet one person not from your household, as long as you maintained a distance of 1.5 metres while you exercised. You weren't allowed to sit in a park, but as long as you were moving, it was pretty much fine. And, you know, there were various permutations of local police forces attempting to enforce things in different ways with various implications, like a man who was jogging home and stopped to get a kebab was... fined, but then let off the fine because the state premier, I think this was in the Northern Territory, it was somewhere not in New South Wales where I live, but the premier in announcing that this person had been let off and everybody could calm down, got a fit of the giggles and was like, I don't know why you would buy a kebab on your run if that's what you choose to do. That's fine.
I think like some context here is necessary because it like, particularly for our Dutch listeners, in that in Australia, if you do something that is illegal, and particularly petty offences, right, like all of this misdemeanor stuff, you're more than likely going to get caught, right? There's a lot of policing, you know, there are roadblocks everywhere for, you know, DUIs, for breath testing. It's there's pretty heavy policing of these sort of minor infractions, parking tickets you can pay $200, right? You know, this sort of stuff.
This is not the case in the Netherlands?
No. I mean,
okay.
You can have expensive fines, but the policing level, I feel like it comparatively is much, much lower for sort of everyday infractions, yeah.
There's also a division of labor, right? We have two different police forces like a municipal kind of unofficial, and they're not called police, but they're kind of security people, and they're the ones who are supposed to be issuing these kinds of fines. Right. And actually, a neighbor of mine, if I can open a parenthesis, a neighbor of mine manages them for Amsterdam or some aspect of their work, and was saying that they're all really tired and stressed out and frustrated having to police these kinds of social distancing norms. But like the quote unquote real police, you know, they follow higher up crime or something like that.
Right.
Higher up crime, it's a new thing. I've just coined it.
Well, yeah, I suppose in Australia it's not uncommon to see police strolling around the neighbourhood. And there's certainly issues around the way in which policing targets certain communities more than others. And there's been some discussion about the fact that more of the infringement notices that were issued during the pandemic in Australia have focused on certain communities in certain suburbs rather than in other communities in other suburbs that may have been similarly flouting broad rules. But I guess the key part of what's happened in Australia is that while there were broad guidelines, there was an element of discretion. And I think the best example of this, our Prime Minister is, his name is Scott Morrison, and he is known as ScoMo by the population, because that's the kind of population we are in Australia. We call our PM ScoMo, and we don't even crack a smile while we do it. So ScoMo, in the early press conferences, it was quite, I suppose, fumbled in the beginning. It wasn't very clear. There was a period where it was all getting very drastic overseas, and yet, although he'd closed the borders to China and I think Iran, there hadn't been any discussion about what social distancing was required in Australia or what the next steps would be. But then there was this week where, I think on the Friday, this is about almost exactly 2 months ago, on the Friday he said non-essential gatherings of 500 or more people will be banned as of Monday, but tomorrow I'm going to go to this massive football match because it might be my last chance to go in quite some time. And then
he said that literally.
He literally said, because it might be my last chance to see my beloved, the team's called the Sharks.
Do it while you can.
Yeah, so then that was heavily criticised overnight, and then he ended up cancelling his trip to that game. Because, you know, but then by the Monday, when he had originally said the 500-person ban was going to, plus ban was going to go through, then the ban had become 100 people. So non-essential gatherings of over 100 people were banned. And then within a couple of days after that, it was non-essential gatherings of 50. And then a couple of days later, it was 10. And then it was 2 by the Friday. So it sort of was this escalating situation where people weren't... It wasn't 100% clear what we were all supposed to be doing. But the best part was that during that week, he held two press conferences. And in the first one, he said, school is going to be closed for all but non-essential... School is going to be closed... for everyone except the children of essential workers. And he was asked the question in the press conference by a journalist, what is an essential worker? What's the definition? And he sort of, it was like he slipped into campaigning mode without realising it. And like, it's like he'd heard the key words, and he started saying, well, every single job in Australia is essential. Every worker is essential. Every person is essential. And he went on this kind of grand rhetoric, which left everybody incredibly confused. And then 2 days later, when he said, you are only allowed to leave the house for essential shopping and for exercise, he was asked the question, what is essential shopping? And he actually said, well, for example, today my wife went down to the local stores to buy some puzzles for our daughters because we're going to be inside for quite some time and they're going to need some activities. So we basically got the message that every job is essential and puzzles constitute essential shopping. So there was obviously a leeway within which people were trying to make their own decisions about what constitutes essential and what doesn't. And so within the community, there are some people who completely went into their homes sort of a la UK style lockdown. And there are other people who, I mean, broadly speaking, the community's been fairly careful. There wasn't a lot of obvious flouting, at least as far as I could tell from my relatively cloistered position. But there were some people who were going out relatively more than other people. And, you know, some people who kept their kids in school, not very many. At my children's school, which is about 400 kids, there were, I had to go in to pick up some books and there were only about 16 kids there at the height of it. So it became something of a matter of community discretion in some areas. There were also some very specific instructions which weren't very clear, like beauticians, tanning salons and massage parlours were closed, but personal trainers could keep training with, again, a sort of decreasing number of people. So it was 10 on the Monday and 5 by the Wednesday and 2 by the Friday again. And there was extensive discussion about the fact that yoga and barre classes were closed, but other things were not closed. And it was all a bit, you could sort of like imagine this group of... Yeah, getting massively into the weeds. Like hairdressers were allowed to stay open, but only if they maintained a social distance of 1.5 metres and only if the appointments were less than 30 minutes. So it's
did
unclear
they put
how
their,
any
like,
hairdressers...
clippers on a long pole or something? Like, how
I've
do
seen...
you...
There were a couple of excellent memes along those lines. One with an umbrella and eyes cut out and the person snipping around the side of the umbrella.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, I don't...
So it sounds like ScoMo was, you know, left something to be desired in the communication, at least, of the plans. But I wonder how you think people reacted to him, given what he how he handled all of the big fires just so recently. Or if you think there's any connection between those two things at all.
Well, he certainly went into the crisis with a very low approval rating because, as many listeners will be aware, Australia's had quite a year. We had bushfires, although it's less well reported that kind of simultaneous to the bushfires, we also had flash floods. And then because the rain came on the back of the drought, there were dust storms and toxic ash clouds. And then there were giant hailstorms. And this is all on the east coast of Australia, which admittedly is quite a large geographical terrain. But it was and he was criticised for the way he handled that because he didn't announce a coordinated national response early on. And in fact, in one of his press conferences said... Basically, in Australia, the firefighting is done in rural communities by volunteers who train, you know, outside their day jobs.
Yeah.
And in announcing that there wouldn't be a sort of government effort to help combat, you know, beyond what is usually in place, he basically said these firefighters, many of whom had taken unpaid leave from their jobs, were there because they wanted to be. And so, you know... That obviously went down quite badly. And then in the middle of the whole thing, he went missing. And we had the Deputy Prime Minister acting as Prime Minister, and it turned out that he'd gone on holidays in Hawaii and was trying to keep that quiet. Yes. And that went down pretty badly as well, because that was at the exact moment that, you know, hundreds of Australians were in emergency evacuation facilities waiting to see if their houses had burned down.
And so it's in a period... Yeah, it's in a period where the like levels of trust in Australian government are pretty low. Like, you spent a long time abroad and then gone home to Australia, and I find it when I go home that people just hate the government and hate politicians generally, right? Like, there's a lot of animus there.
Yeah, and also we... Another little known fact about Australia is that we are the democratic coup capital of the world. We had something like 7 prime ministers in 10 years, often the same prime minister coming back, because in our system we don't directly elect the prime minister. It's like the Westminster system. And so the implication, what's happened is parties have taken down the leader whose party, who was elected as the head of the party, to replace them with someone else. And yeah, there's a lot of cynicism about politics, and certainly when ScoMo's first press conferences were quite fumbling, there was a lot of rolled eyes, and a lot of groups within the community were kind of having side conversations about what they felt was safe, because we weren't getting very clear direction. So, you know, groups of people that I'm connected with professionally and socially was sort of sharing ideas about what we thought was a reasonable response, or, you know, trying to talk to doctors that they knew. And that did create, I think, quite a bit of uncertainty. But then as it settled, you know, after that initial panic, I suppose his approval rating's gone up quite a bit because he's seen to have overseen Australia dealing with the pandemic in a way that's world leading, I suppose, for want of a better term. So he's looking better now than he was.
One area where they don't seem to be world leading is the area that you're working on yourself, Sanushka, right? The area of migrant workers, and particularly, and maybe you can start by giving us a little bit of background about temporary workers in Australia, which unbeknownst to a lot of people who work on migration generally and who think about Australia as an anti-immigration sort of state, there is this huge population of temporary workers that that have had a lot of difficulties in terms of their positioning vis-a-vis the state and regulations during the crisis.
Yes, so Australia traditionally is a settler state where if you arrived as a migrant, you had a pathway to permanent residence, and that's how my parents came in the 70s, and your parents too, Darshan. And it's however, and of course, we're well known internationally for our aggressively international law defying stance on refugees and asylum seekers. And because of that, there's less awareness that in the last 20 years, we've seen an explosion of temporary migration. Visas which are both, some of them are for work purposes, but the vast majority are actually officially designated for other things like international student visas, working holiday visas. Yet those numbers are skyrocketing, and those workers, most of these visas have work rights attached to them. That mean that those workers are slotting into our economy and fulfilling, in some cases, essential roles, and in other cases, well, largely essential, I suppose. There's tourism, hospitality, agriculture, logistics. And a lot of these workers are people who don't have permanent residence rights, who don't have access to social rights, and often have work restrictions attached to their visa that's become a form of it's the sort of trigger for precarious work conditions because, for example, international students have a limited number of hours that they're allowed to work, and there's become a sort of sideline where certain industries, unscrupulous employers in certain industries, allow workers to work more than their designated number of hours, but then at the same time use that as leverage over those workers to say, well, I'll report you to the Department of Immigration. And because there's, you know, it's well known that Australia puts people that it deems to be illegal in detention centres and in offshore processing, that's quite a powerful threat in our context. So that workforce has expanded to be about 11% of the Australian workforce, which is huge. We're the second highest. We have the second highest migrant workforce in the OECD after the US.
Right.
And in the context of COVID, so there were a whole range of issues around exploitation of this workforce prior to COVID. But in the context of COVID and in announcing welfare packages and emergency relief related to the pandemic, the government has expressly said that not only temporary workers and citizens, sorry, only permanent residents and citizens are entitled to COVID welfare relief. So temporary workers don't get part of the $130 billion rescue package that the government announced. And the implication of that is that a lot of those workers have lost their jobs, but there's also an incentive in doling out work not to hire those workers back. Right. If because the government's welfare package, basically the centrepiece of the government's welfare package is for 6 months, employers of citizens and permanent residents will receive $1,500 every fortnight per eligible employee if your business has reduced earnings by a certain percentage. So a lot of temporary workers have found that they're the ones that are the first to be laid off.
Yeah.
And they're also, particularly in the casual workforce, where a lot of these workers exist partly in some cases. For example, working holiday makers are only allowed to work for the same employer for 6 months at a time. You can't work after 6 months with one employer. You have to move on to another employer. So those workers wouldn't have been eligible anyway, but they also are the first to be let go and are having huge problems with housing, keeping up with rent, paying for food. One of the community centres near where I live, it's called Addison Road Community Centre. It provides a food pantry in normal times, and it's now providing emergency hampers to people who are struggling with food security issues. It's had over 6,000 international students come in for a food hamper because they're having such trouble meeting their daily needs.
And is there much discussion about this in the media? I know you're actively working on these issues, but are you getting any traction? And is there any possible measures that are being contemplated now by the government?
Well, there has been some media coverage, which has been good to see. And that's not to say the government's done nothing for these people, but the things that they've done, to give you some examples. There are visa extensions that are available. But the COVID visa, the free visa that you can get, is only available as a last resort. So if you are on one of these temporary visas, you need to try and apply for a different temporary visa first before you can say, I'm eligible for the COVID visa. So there's that. There's been a relaxation on some of the working conditions. So the government said quite early, temporary workers who work in aged care or in health facilities or in supermarkets can work more hours than they would otherwise be entitled under their visa conditions. So you can see where I'm going with this.
Yeah.
So there's an extent to which we have created a community of people, approximately 1.1 million people, who are forced to work in the essential industries, agriculture being a key one, that keep the rest of society safe and happy, whereas other workers are able to say, well, I'm going to stay at home because I have that choice because the government's offering this welfare package, or I can negotiate with my employer.
Yeah, no, I'm interested to hear what forms of mobilisation have happened in response to this. I the first thing I heard about it was when ScoMo famously told a lot of the students to just pack up and go home. And so many people realised what a ridiculous nature of that assumption that they could simply leave, that they didn't have, were not in any way vested in Australia. And I've seen since then some sort of, you know, some stuff on social media about people using that term and that meme to sort of raise people's consciousness that we are at home here, right? This is where we live. I don't know whether that's sort of dovetailed into any sort of... any actions, any protests, any more attempts or attempts to show solidarity with all of these workers.
I mean, there's certainly a lot of people who have mobilised in various ways. One of those ways, of course, is the sort of civil society organising, and there's been a national committee set up, which is composed of unions and NGOs and other community groups and migrant representative groups and other refugee settlement services. And that group's coordinating to try and sort of tactically determine how to approach their strategy on this. There's been obviously a lot of letters from the community and as well as coordinated letters to politicians and quite a few media articles, quite a lot of media attention. Particularly, I think there was a level of public consciousness about this because over the past few years, there have been a number of massive scandals involving exploitation of temporary workers in big chains like 7-Eleven.
Right.
And there's another bubble tea chain that employed lots of international students and was underpaying them. So there was an underlying awareness of wage theft, which is one of the key ways in which temporary workers in Australia are being exploited. But I would say, unfortunately, that I don't think that advocacy has had much of an impact on a political level. And part of the reason for that, I think, stems from the toxic politics around immigration globally, because the more we shout and say temporary workers are people too and deserve to be treated the same as citizens, or at least deserve to have their humanity recognised, the more that gives the right-wing conservative forces in our society the opportunity, you know, handed to them on a platter to say, no, we're tough on refugees and we're tough on migrants and we put Australians first, and we, you know, if they don't like it, they can go home. Yeah. And that's pretty disturbing, which is not to say, I mean, a lot of the workers that I've come across in my work have said things like, you know, our neighbours have been amazing, they've left food packages for us, or, you know, somebody came round and dropped some money through our door, our letterbox, because they knew that we're a refugee family and that we're struggling to get by. So that it's not to say that the entire community is terrible, but certainly at the level of political discourse, it's not possible to say temporary migrants have rights without being shouted down by a very powerful force, which ultimately isn't amenable to the arguments that it's in our economic interests to protect these people. So even sort of, even utilitarian arguments, none of those things fly. And I shouldn't have been surprised, but certainly the United Nations Network for Migration very early in the piece released a statement that was headed, you know, COVID-19 does not discriminate and nor should we in our response. It's just logical to say that if you've got a community of people who are unable to self-isolate if they think they're ill, who are forced to work, forced to choose between staying at home and being ill or buying food for that week, that you're endangering the entire community. And yet even those arguments aren't being heard. I mean, politicians to this day, bearing in mind the borders have been closed, there've been hardly any flights for months now, they still say, if you don't like it, go home. You know, I don't even know what that's supposed to mean. It's
how are they going to get there?
Because it's not really about the reality.
Yeah. I mean, in the US, it's also been the case that this whole crisis has then allowed or, you know, served as an opportunity for anti-immigration people in the administration to even close avenues for legal immigration further than what they have been before. And that includes green cards, right? So green cards are in the US are, you know, the legal channel by which you become a permanent resident, and it's highly regulated already. It is no easy task to get one. And then they just say, no, we're not doing it anymore, you know, indefinitely. And that kind of, it just, it's like, why? You know, that doesn't cost anything. It's just a very, very clearly political statement to apparently distract, you know, supporters who are already supportive of cracking down on immigration anyway. It's more like a dog whistle than a real policy. And they also, I just read, are not even issuing any passports right now to Americans. Like, so they're just like, no one's going in or out. Or if you're here already, you are in a very precarious situation, right? If they stop the process of going, of, you know, evaluating your claims for a green card. And in the meantime, if you then overstay or pass some deadlines, you know, to move to the next step of the process, it's a very precarious situation for individuals. So I don't want to make light of it. Like, it's not a, it doesn't have any implications for people's lives. Of course it does. But in the terms of like a policy, just why, you know?
But it's also just, I think this is the first time, certainly in my life, in our lives, that it hasn't been possible to get on a plane to go home or to be expelled the way that it ordinarily is. And that places, part of my work is about temporary, low-wage temporary workers in the region. And that places those workers in a position, you know, many of whom have been residents in the country that they're working over successive visa periods. It places them in a new position that as societies and as communities, we're not responding to by changing the rules of the game. If you can't go home, that doesn't mean anything different for the situation that you're in. So you are functionally, I mean, many of these workers wouldn't have been able to go home anyway because they're tied to employers or need the employer's permission to leave, or you know, various things. They have to wait for employers to pay their flights. But it is a different situation to not have those flights available.
I'm interested, like, particularly because, you know, you're someone who's, you know, unlike us, not just involved in researching these issues, but in actually advocating for real change. And I'm interested to, like, so you're sort of suggesting that there's this possibility to kind of separate out migration issues from sort of the highly politicized and charged, you know, public debates around this issue, and that maybe you can get sort of the necessary work done in a sort of more softly way, whilst, you know, the politicians can go and rail about these issues. And I don't know, like, do you have examples of successes that work like that? Because I know that these policies, like in Australia and places like this, just sort of proliferate out of nowhere, right? And suddenly you have this population that sits underneath all of these vague visas. And you see this example in a number of cases, but when push comes to shove, what protects these groups, right, in cases like this from more draconian policies, from, you know, systematic neglect or those sorts of things?
Well, firstly, I don't think researchers contribute nothing.
So, thank you.
I just want to say, go on.
No, really. I mean, in a lot of the work that sort of advocacy or activists, it needs to be grounded in the academic research that exists on these areas, and because our experience is quite often quite local, you need to have that broader perspective. I think it's a really hard question, because in some ways my argument that perhaps there's a way to sort of go under the radar and have some of these things be addressed is born out of the abject failure of any other attempts to create meaningful protections.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that I could say this is a strategy that necessarily works, but it is certainly the one that I think is perhaps more likely to work in this environment, because the dog whistle politics in Australia and many countries is so entrenched that politicians will not make public announcements which may be seen to be favouring migrants who are not part of the voting population by definition. And so one of the, well, to give you an example, when the COVID welfare package was announced and temporary workers weren't included, there was a period during which activists were kind of rushing to lobby before the Act passed Parliament for temporary workers to be included. And in that period, I was strategizing with some others, and we thought what we needed to do was find an industry leader who could have a quiet word, you know, somebody who was in with the government who would be willing to have a quiet word about the implications, because, you know, we're talking about fruit picking and all these other things. But, well, first of all, we weren't able to find someone. The extent to which that was because we don't have the right contacts is... you know, that might be the reason. It's not that we didn't reach out to quite a few major industry groups, you know, the CSR departments in those groups. But yeah, we weren't able to find someone who was willing to take that stand. And I guess part of the reason for that is pragmatically, I mean, now, for example, the argument, seasonal fruit picking is now being done by working holiday makers who don't have any jobs in cities anymore and are forced to go out and do it. So there is a labour force. So pragmatically, I guess these industry groups were thinking to themselves, well, why do we need to sacrifice our political capital on this altar?
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe we could, as like by way of wrapping up our conversation, we can speculate a little bit about whether or not you think this pandemic will have any impact on either just migration practices or the broader migration politics. I mean, on the practical side, we know we're in a bit of limbo, I think, about how movement of people is going to look or be regulated differently potentially because of the disease threat. And if you and your groups are having discussions about that yet, or
look into your
crystal balls, what you personally think about that problem. Yeah, just tell us.
Yeah.
Or do you think it will be more like more of the same, actually?
I'm not sure. Possible. There was actually, I was part of a conversation a couple of weeks ago, which was about whether in the Australian context, this is a moment to have a meaningful policy debate about our migration program. Is it possible? Like, this seems like an ideal moment. Certainly because temporary workers are more high profile than they have been sort of in recent memory as a result of these issues around welfare.
Yeah.
And there were strong arguments on both sides. And one of the arguments was, if we open this debate, we will only end up with less than we have now.
Right.
It will be, there will be an unashamed attempt to roll back worker rights. And it's dangerous under this government and this political climate in Australia, because there's a bit of a bipartisan consensus that the population won't deal well with discussions about migrant rights. And it's interesting because Australia's done this clever trick, or Australian society, where migrants of my parents' generation can now be rabidly anti-refugees and migrants themselves. There's a real kicking away the ladder, and I haven't looked at the extent to which it's replicated in other societies, but that's a constant source of dismay, I suppose. I don't know, Darshan, you must have thoughts on this because you will have seen the same thing.
Yeah, migrants suck. Like, I'm sorry. Like, we do the same thing, and like, yeah, second generation and third generation, we turn on the new group coming in, and it's a repeated pattern. Particularly, I think you see it particularly in countries of immigration like Australia, the United States, of this pattern of, and the other thing, I mean, there's lots of other things that I don't like about it. But it's all often a very much like when in the migrant rights organizing that I saw in Australia, mine was very much in the Sri Lankan community, and it was very much, and not just the Sri Lankan Tamil community, and it was very much squarely focused on securing refugee rights for Sri Lankan Tamils, right? And getting it beyond that broader agenda was quite tough. I'm sure there is other good work being done, but that was my experience of it.
I guess when I think about what I would like to do in the coming sort of year or so, is take the awareness about these issues and start to have, you know, perhaps not national conversations, but start to think about what a coherent policy platform that might be sellable under a different government.
Monday morning meetings on migration is brought to you by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can find us on our WordPress site or alternatively on Facebook or Twitter. If you have ideas about a show that we ought to feature or a guest that we ought to have on, please contact Abby or I on imes@uva.nl.